Working Cows Podcast, Episode 88.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Hi, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network. And we are here today with another episode for you guys, brought to you by the High Plains Ranch Practicum. Registration is open now for the last of the High Plains Ranch Practicum classes. More on that in a bit, but I wanted to let you know that registration is open now, and this is the last opportunity that you have to get in on that. So take advantage of it. Seriously, no matter where you're at, it's worth the drive. It is 2 days a month over the course of 4 separate months, but I really think it's worth the drive pretty much no matter where you're coming from. You can make it work. I would encourage you to do it. So do consider that option that is laid before you. Every once in a while, I find somebody on social media that I follow, and I start paying attention to what they're talking about, what they're doing, and Brian Alexander is one such guy who has reached out to me, and we've talked and conversed and had some phone calls, and he attended Grass-Fed Exchange and got challenged a little bit there and decided to make some changes to his operation, and so I decided to ask him to come on and tell us a little bit about that. So, Brian, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, Clay. It's an honor to be here.
You recently attended the Grass-Fed Exchange and have come home with some new ideas and practices that you're looking to implement. Can you tell me a little bit about some of your experience there at the Grass-Fed Exchange?
Well, without getting a lot of backstory, I guess we'll just jump right in. Grass-Fed Exchange, like you said, I went to Grass-Fed Exchange last month. First time I've ever been to a Grass-Fed Exchange, only about the second time I've ever been to California. It was a great experience, and just being able to get out of my comfort zone and network a little bit and talk to some other producers and visit a couple of ranches out there and just be able to drive around and kind of with a new eye and see what agriculture in California looks like. Very beneficial. The big thing that I came home from Grass-Fed Exchange with was an idea. It just really reinforced everything that I'd been thinking for the last couple of years and everything that I've researched and all the conclusions I've made in the last couple of years.
What has been your training background up to this point in your ranching career?
Completely unconventional. I grew up on the ranch with my dad, and it's never been a conventional ranching operation. Dad came out, he took over the ranch about 1984, 1988, maybe as early as 86. He'd been to ranching for profit, when Stan Parsons still had it, when all the schools were down in Albuquerque. So I was exposed to the ranching for profit principles and holistic management principles from really early age. All my other friends are like, oh, hey, check out this roping horse I got. Oh, you know, we're going to go, you know, rope some cattle. Like, oh, great. You know, dad's talking about mineral cycling and water cycling. And, you know, my friends are wanting to go rope cattle, and I have no idea. So, Didn't have a lot of friends because I was never in a rodeo or any of that growing up. But I did try to listen to what Dad was doing and pay attention to what he was doing as much as I could. He went to ranching for profit again in the late 90s and again in 2006 or 2004. I went in 2006, and I've also been to holistic management training series in Hastings, Nebraska. That was in 2014.
And what impact did that have on you? Just kind of shoring up what Dad had been teaching you all along, or?
Yeah, you could say that. Some of it is, and the curriculum advances over time too. So as these guys that have been doing it for a long time, like Dad, Burke Tyker, Wally Olson, Kit Farrow, some of these guys have been around forever. You know, their knowledge continues to evolve, and the curriculum of ranching for profit and holistic management, you know, also continues to evolve. And I'll say that it's been real interesting to be an observer or be part of the ranching for profit curriculum over the last, 20, 25 years. I'm watching it grow to what it is. So, as we all gain as us regenerative producers, the community, as we collectively gain knowledge, the tools and the training are just getting better and better and better and better because we're all sharing our failures, right? And it's not that we're sharing our successes. We're all having success for the same reason, but we're not having failures for the same reason as the power of the regenerative ag community to be able to share our failures and be able to go out and reach out to other people in a community and say, hey, this didn't work. Can anybody tell me why it didn't work or what I can do different next time? That's what's really great about the regenerative community. I don't see that at all on the production side.
Was that opportunity enhanced by the grass-fed exchange?
Oh, of course. Like I said, anytime you can get around, 500 like-minded people that are passionate about regenerative agriculture and soil health and carbon-positive agriculture, it does really good things for your soul. I don't know how many of my friends and neighbors in my community listen to this. I might upset some of what I'm about to say, but after being in California for 8 days, seeing all the beauty and the green and the trees and, being on Stemple Creek Ranch, being up at Sonoma Mountain Institute, seeing these beautiful ranches and this beautiful green grass, get on an airplane and fly home. We fly over mountains halfway, and then as soon as we get out of mountains, we're flying over production and commodity agriculture, irrigated circles and bare dirt, get ready for beans and corn and, and wheat. And I look down at this side of the airplane, I'm going, man, where did we go wrong here? Where did we go wrong?
I could give you an opinion on that.
The production side, they don't share their failures. They want to hide their failures. They want to hide what's not working for them, right? Because most of them are, they're in, $1 million, $2 million deep in the bank. And as regen guys, we're working out of our checkbook. We don't mind sharing our failures because we've already been there, done that, learned how to pass it. The production guys, they won't share their failures. They won't talk about them. They'll just ignore them and cover it up with a chemical.
Right. I think that is really it. I mean, that covering it up with a chemical is a microcosm of where that side of the business has gone wrong. I think that animals are the answer to that. That there is an opportunity to cycle those nutrients without having to use as much or any chemical fertilizer if you're willing to think a little bit differently about it and maybe look crazy to the neighbors.
Well, I've said it for a long time. There's no such thing as a brush problem in a pasture. There's no such thing as a brush problem. Whether you're looking at sand plums or sumac or sagebrush, there's no such thing as a brush problem. There's only a lack of browse animals problem.
Right.
Lack of browse animals, lack of stock density. Those are the two problems out here in southern Kansas. It's not, it's not a weed. It's not an aphid. It's lack of stock density and lack of browse animals, period.
I think that was my takeaway from the episode with Alan Savory, that's basically the problem everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't disagree with him. There's very little that Alan Savory says that I can ever find anything to disagree with. We might butt heads a little bit when it comes to fire, wildfire frequency discussions about the high plains, but that's really the only thing I can get sideways with Alan Savory about.
Right, and the fire is a tool because there's a lack of browse animals. Is that your perspective, or?
It's hard to say. Fire's a tool like anything else, like any other cows are tools, fire's tool, chemicals are tools. Correctly applied, it's a great thing. And, I practice a lot of range burning. In fact, that's why they had me at a grass-fed exchange, because they wanted to pick my brain about prescribed fire and wildfire recovery. I'm starting to get more concerned about the carbon emissions from pasture burning. If we follow what Savory says and we're grazing properly, we shouldn't need to burn because there's not going to be that dead decaying oxidizing plant matter. But that target is so hard to hit. It's so hard to hit. we're either going to be just a little bit over and we're going to abuse our pasture, or we're going to be just a little bit under, and we're going to have that dead oxidizing material that every once in a while is going to need to be reset with fire.
Right.
So I don't anticipate fire ever coming out of my management toolbox that I'm going to use on my ranch. But I anticipate that it's going to be a tool I'm going to need to use far less frequently going into the future as I improve my grazing management and attempt to reintroduce browse animals.
So you've mentioned the grass-fed exchange a few times.
You mentioned that they had you out there to pick your brain about using fire and recovery from fire. There's also a large swath of the center part of our country right now and a lot of beef animals that have been lost to a snowstorm. Can you talk about your experience in recovering from a fire?
Well, first off, I didn't lose any livestock in the wildfire 3 years ago because I'm a custom grazer for now. As far as forage recovery, you know, if you've got good root reserves and you had good forage before the fire, you know, all it takes is a little bit of moisture and a little bit of time and a little, you know, you're going to grow a lot of grass. The pastures that are, you know, have been abused for years and years and years and, you know, horribly overgrazed that didn't, you know, that didn't have very much forage on them when the fire came through. We're talking, you know, 500 to 1,000 pounds of, you know, basically buffalo grass. It's, you know, 2 or 3 inches tall and just a carpet. Those places still look the same. You know, they still have the big bushy sagebrush. They still have the really short grass. They just suffer from a lack of stock density. You know, the plants have no time to recover. They never have had any time to recover. And the pasture just suffers from a lack of stock density. And that's what surrounds me. You know, there's some of my neighbors that are decent managers, you know, that rotate their cattle and, you know, they have good grass. And it really shows. You know, a fire like that will really show a good manager from a bad one. You know, my dad has a saying, he says, short grass, short management, tall grass, tall management.
Yep. And so what about from the infrastructure side of that? How was that recovery process been for you?
Actually, remarkably, I had almost everything rebuilt within 6 months. I have 44.2 miles of barbed wire fence and 18.6 miles of electric fence. In that 44.2 miles of barbed wire fence, we had to replace approximately 140 H braces, and all 18 and a half miles of wire had to come out. I had to pull it all out because it was all damaged in the fire, and we had to string completely new wire, replace about 70% of my electric fence posts. Probably 90% of the wood posts that were in the fence, not the H brace, those all burned up. So a lot of that got replaced with steel T-post. I'm never going to set another wood corner, another hedge corner in my life. Never do that again because they burn up. You know, I'll set steel corners in concrete. You know, that'll be there forever. I don't care if they're cheap and my neighbors think they're ugly. I don't care. They're cheap, and it's not going to burn out. Yeah, I actually used some fairly small pipe that, you know, everybody says, oh, that's too small, but it's holding tension just fine. And, you know, if those steel corners burn out of my fence, we've got a lot more problems than the steel corners burn out of the fence.
Yeah. So that was going to be my next question. Did you take the opportunity to change any infrastructure as a result of kind of the reset button being hit involuntarily?
Oh, we moved. Some electric fence got moved. Just, you know, realigned a little bit to make it more convenient. But for the most part, the barbed wire fences all stayed right where they were. You know, it was so much cheaper just to replace, you know, just to fix what was there versus tearing everything out around a hot wire or moving it. And, you know, some of that was also done in the interest of speed because I got to make a living too.
Right.
You know, of the three cells on the ranch, normally I take cattle in on May 1st and 2016, I got cattle in on May 14th. So I was only 2 weeks late in one cell, and I think it was about 2 weeks after that I came into the other cell. And the third cell I ended up resting all year. We rested it the whole summer 2016, and then we came in with about 250 pair in the fall, and I'm trying to tromp down as much as we could. Fortunately, we got about a half-inch ice storm that winter, which really helped break a lot of that tall grass down and put it on the ground for litter.
When did that fire hit?
Oh, March 22nd through 26th, 2016. It came onto the ranch just a little bit after probably 11:15 in the morning, north of the highway, and it didn't take very long to cover it because by that time the wind was blowing about 40 miles an hour.
Were there dark days during those times?
Of course there were. You know, you have to sit there and watch, and you feel helpless, and you watch this fire just roll right across your ranch. And, you know, the only thing you can think, well, the only thing I can think, since I don't have cattle, I imagine everybody that had cattle is, you know, freaking out, trying to, you know, get gates open and find a safe haven for their cattle. I was just thinking, okay, how much work am I going to have to do? You know, what am I going to have to do to get back in shape for fences? How long am I going to have to wait for rain to grow some grass? You know, those are my thoughts. You know, there's no throw your hands up and quit. You know, there's no fold up and go to town and get a job. You know, thoughts never occurred to me. It's, you know, well, it is what it is. Let's figure out what we got to do to get it put back together so we can start making some money.
Absolutely. So what was your main takeaway from the GrassFed Exchange? What is different on your operation today as a result of being there than it was prior to attending?
Ooh, well, I've planned to do things, and I've bought materials to do things, but I haven't actually gone out and done work yet, like physical work. But what you're asking me about is we're going to do a strip grazing experiment this year, and a lot of the motivation to try this strip grazing experiment came from GrassFed Exchange and the people that I talked to and the things that I saw, the presentations I listened to, and just the other conference attendees that I networked with and had a good chance to talk to.
And how are you planning to do this strip grazing experiment? What's the time of year? What are some of those things?
Well, it's in a paddock that's it's about 250 acres, lightly grazed last year. It's just been traditionally lightly grazed. It has water in it, but it doesn't have any fence, any internal fences. So we're going to go in and we're going to build about 2 miles of, I'd call it permanent type cable electric fence. And that's what I'm going to use as a backbone to run all my strip fences off of. I got a bunch of polywire and pigtail posts to do what my strip grazes with. So I figure if I can go out there and I can do about a 3.5 to 4 acre paddock every day for these 150 Coriana calf pairs that I have, somewhere between a 2.5 to 4 acre paddock a day, should be plenty of forage. 4 acres should get my herd impact up to about 37,500 pounds an acre. And four acres a day should let me cover it easy twice in 120 days. So I don't know if it's going to work. I think it'll work.
What are the unknowns or the challenges at this point for you?
Well, the Corianas, for one. number two, they've never seen a hot wire. And number three, they've been basically, my friend got these out of Arizona. He's been putting together these Corianas, you know, out of the Southwest, you know, Arizona and Texas for years. He buys, sells, trades cattle all the time. So some of these are coming off of ranches that they were like 120 or 200 acres per cow. You know, he brings them here and he's running about 20 acres a cow. Okay, that's fine. Well, I'm going to put 150 of them in 4 acres. So it's going to be interesting. And I like the Coriana breed from what I've seen of them. You know, especially coming from real poor country, you know, poor country to the Southwest of us where it's hotter and drier, bring them up here. They just, you know, they explode on this grass. You know, they come off the truck and they look like death warmed over. And 2 weeks later on grass without, you know, eating grass and drinking water, like no supplements, they look really good. So it's just kind of, experimental. I'll watch how the calves grow. I'll watch how the calves perform more than I'm going to be worried about the cows in this deal. And watch the grass, of course, you know, because the grass is what makes us money.
Absolutely. How did you come to make the decision to experiment with this?
I just felt like I didn't have enough to do with, you know, three other herds of cattle to move. You know, those other three, two of them are going to be moved every day or every other day. So there's going to be days where I'm going to be moving cattle. I'm going to have to go move three herds. And then if I have time, you know, I might build another strip for the Corianas and move them again. So I haven't had time to sit down and figure out all the complexities of all four herds and everybody's move schedules, and that just might be something that I'm going to do, you know, okay, well, I've got to move this, and this, and we're just going to have to play it by ear. I've never tried to bite off this much on this often of moves. I think last year total, I think I ended up with about 120 or 124 moves total last year. I'm going to do that in less than 60 days this year.
And how many herds did you run last year?
I had three last year.
And what's the nature of the infrastructure where you aren't strip grazing?
It's all surrounded by 5-wire barbed wire fence. I've got some 4-wire internal, but it's all cable type electric fence. all the internal divisions. So one of the cells I call the corral cell currently has 27 paddocks. I could probably get that pushed up to 35 this year, and that's on about 2,300 acres. The south cell, sometimes I throw the bull pasture in with it. Sometimes this year, obviously, it's not. So it's going to be about 1,650 acres, and it's in 22 paddocks, and we may go in later and strip graze that out a little bit. That's going to hold about 240 replacement heifers. And then my last cell, it's only four paddocks, and it's 2,500 acres, and we're just going to – it's basically rotational overgraze set stock, similar to what everybody else does. It doesn't have – it's not well-developed. It doesn't have much water, which is why it doesn't have very many cross fences.
Sure.
And it's four big paddocks. So that's a project whose time is coming. I have spent hours and hours and hours and hours on the computer designing fences, designing water, and trying to figure out what works over there. So that's a plan down the road. Did it get your question?
Yeah, yeah. Are your internal cross fences, are they all for barbed wire, or are there some of them that are semi-permanent electric fence? Are there some of them that are permanent electric fence? Do you use temporary electric fence other than this new strip grazing experiment?
Well, I would separate the strip grazing fence from what I would call my permanent electric fence. My strip grazing fence actually comes out to almost, it's about 2.5 times, almost 3 times more expensive than what I call my permanent type electric fence. I use the 3/8 fiberglass post with the metal clip, and I pull a real small diameter galvanized cable. That's what I use for my wire.
Sure.
And I have 18.6 miles of that. We'll put the most complex system, probably has over 2.5 miles on one energizer, and I use all solar energizers with a battery.
And the kind of rule of thumb in ranching for profit is that if you can recover 100% of the investment up front or in year one, that it's a good thing to do. Is that realistic with this strip grazing experiment?
100%. I before I committed to it, I had an idea of what the fencing was going to cost and what my labor input was going to be. And, you know, obviously I know how much money I'm going to charge the client. And once I put the numbers down on paper and saw how well it cash flowed, I absolutely have to do this. And this is one of those things, like, let's see, we're going to come in probably either Tuesday or Wednesday next week, 34 days. If I can keep them 34 days, I paid for all my investment.
Nice.
So, yeah, you know, anything after 34 days is a bonus. I know I can get 60 days easy. 90 days, probably no sweat. 120 days is going to take a little bit of planning and a lot of work, but we'll get there.
As I said in the intro, this is the last year of the High Plains Ranch Practicum, and it's definitely right up there with the top of the ranch business training schools that are available, and I would encourage you to make an effort to get there and to be involved in it and to take advantage of the content and the networking and the wisdom that is represented by Dallas and the other instructors, and Aaron Berger and the other instructors and the guest ranchers that come in and talk. Very, very much worth your time. So head up hpranchpracticum.com and get into this year's class. What other resources and tools are you using in this experiment? You've mentioned PastureMap a couple of times. Anything else like that that you're making use of?
PastureMap and Google Earth. Like Google Earth Pro and PastureMap are the only two pasture planning tools I really need.
And what role do they play? How are they helping in this?
You know, PastureMap, obviously, that's where I'm managing all my herds, you know, all my stock records, my forage inventories, move records, everything, you know, everything stays in PastureMap. What I use Google Earth for is, you know, I'll have all my pastures and subdivisions drawn out in PastureMap. I want to do a major change, I export that that KMZ file up to Google Earth, and then I can play with it in Google Earth, and it's much easier to do, to sketch and add things and move things around in Google Earth and see how that affects areas without messing up PastureMap.
Sure.
So Google Earth is kind of like, you know, Google Earth is my sketch pad, I suppose.
And what are you looking forward to with this strip grazing experiment? What are some of the things you're excited to see, how they work, and some of those things?
Clay, I believe in my heart it's going to work. You know, I think I'm a good enough stockman and a good enough fence builder that, you know, I can pull this off and I can make it work. Whether or not I'm a good enough scientist to be able to document all the results properly, that's kind of what I'm worried about. One of the things that I'm going to force myself to do for accountability is I'm going to try to update social media every day or at least every other day with progress on the strip grazing experiment or what insight I've gained in the last day or two from the experiment and what new knowledge that's given me. So I want to really try to share those lessons on social media from, you know, I started the other day with a post about, hey, I bought all this crap, I'm going to do this strip grazing experiment, wish me luck. I started with that and I want to end up in about 120, 130 days and go back and say, and stand on the first strip they grazed in waist tall grass and say, this is what it looked like.
Nice.
You know, you saw the pictures of what it looked like when it came off. You saw what it looked like at 60 days. You saw now you see what it looks like now. So I think that'll be a fun project to do this summer. You know, it'll keep me tied to it. Hopefully it should generate some investment and some commitment from some fans. And I want to show the world that it works. I know that it's going to work. It's just learn how to manage the problems along the way.
You've been practicing your daily posts with your posts about the prescribed burning, so I think you're well on your way there.
Well, those are kind of easy to do because I could just, you know, oh, hey, cool fire in the background. That's a quick one. You know, grass-fed exchange, you know, social media is really powerful, and you know, for a long time, I look at how many followers I had on my page or on my Instagram account. I'm like, yeah, it's not that great because I was comparing it to the wrong kind of people. You know, the fan base that I have, I'm tremendously thankful for. You know, the fan base I have, I've never sold them anything, and it keeps growing. It keeps growing, which tells me that there's people out there that agree with my message, that are agreeing with what I'm saying, and they believe it strongly enough that they're spreading it with their friends, and their friends are understanding it, and they're wanting to know more. So growing kind of organically like that, you know, I need to focus on me, what I'm doing, and a positive message, and not worry about how many subscribers I have.
I do really want to be a part of documenting this process, at least at the very end. I'd like to have you back on and talk a little bit more about your experience and what it was that you accomplished and how you think it went and what you think could be done better next time.
I'd love that. I'll come on and talk to you anytime you want to call me, Clay.
Absolutely.
Here's the record button.
Yes, sir. Yep. I won't catch you off guard. So you mentioned your Instagram account and your Twitter or your Facebook account. Can you tell people how to keep up with you and how to see what's going on so that they can follow you along in this journey?
Yeah, Clay. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and I'm also on Twitter. You were trying to chat with me on Twitter like a week, 10 days ago, and I was trying to figure out how to have a conversation on Twitter, and I don't understand it. I do Facebook and I do Instagram well. Twitter is just kind of a repost, and you can find me at Red Hills Rancher. So it'd be facebook.com/Red Hills Rancher, also on Instagram and Twitter. And I have a YouTube account, a YouTube channel. I haven't put up a lot of content lately on YouTube. It's so easy to do a 1 minute or a 2 minute video and put it on Facebook or Instagram these days than it is to, you know, sit down and cut together a big long video clip and put it up on YouTube. I just haven't had time to do much on YouTube, but hopefully this fall I've got access to all my footage archived for the last 5 years, and I'm hopefully going to make some YouTube videos this fall.
Yeah, cool. And let's talk about your resource base. I don't want to leave that on the table either. Can you tell me a little bit about your resource base there in Kansas?
Well, I'm down in the Red Hills of Kansas, so I'm about halfway east-west from Colorado to Missouri, but I'm only about 20 miles from Oklahoma. Like I said, it's not typical flat Kansas like everybody's used to seeing when you're driving down 35 or driving down I-70. They put those roads in the flat places because that's where it's cheapest to build, and those are kind of the ugliest parts of the state, and that's fine. We want you to stay on those roads. It's really pretty. Where I am, we get on an average of about 22 to 24 inches of rainfall in a normal year, and normal is a setting on a dryer, and average is just a number that we never get. I would say we're probably somewhere in a neighborhood of about a 7 on the brittleness scale. We can have a summer where it won't be more than 85 degrees and it'll be humid every day. We can have a summer where it's 100 degrees every day for 100 days. A lot of variability down here. The forages we grow, I'm lucky, and of my 7,000 acres, I would say probably at least 4,500 of it has never seen a plow. So I have probably 4,500 acres minimum of pristine, native, undisturbed soil that's never been broke out, never seen a plow, nothing. There was some areas on the ranch that were farmed all the way up into the 80s. Dad put the last of that back to grass in 1985. So we're 100% native range. And what he did plant was planted back with a local native grass mix. So it wasn't a bunch of, you know, imported crap like Old World Bluestem or, you know, Johnson grass or something else horrible. So we're all native range, about 22, 24 inches of rain a year. Forage production on the low end will be, you know, around 1,000, 1,500 pounds an acre, places that are kind of abused or waste, all the way up to, I've got a few places that I've grown on top of 6,000 pounds of the acre of Indian grass.
Sounds real good. I appreciate that perspective and helping us out with some of the understanding of that. There will be links to everything that Brian and I have talked about today at workingcows.net/88. And Brian, I look forward to future conversations with you about this experiment and about your ranch business as a whole. So one last thing, what are you producing? You're producing cattle that other people own. That's your product, is you're selling grass that to people who own cattle, and you're kicking out a fat cow calf pair at the end of the year.
That's another way of saying you sunlight salesman, but yes.
Yes. Good. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah, if we're in agriculture, Clay, we're all in the same business. Okay. And you can have that, and you can have one of two job descriptions in agriculture. All right. We're all in the business of converting sunlight into protein. And you can do that one of two ways. You can either be a solar commodity broker, or you can be a dirt miner. I prefer to be a solar commodity broker, but I know a lot of dirt miners.
Sure. I've pretended to wrap this episode up about 3 times. I don't want to leave one thing on the table that you said about the brittleness scale. Is that your own system, or is there a brittleness scale that actually exists?
Years ago, I heard that the brittleness scale was kind of from 1 to 10, right? And the most brittle environment you can imagine would be a 10, and the most stable environment would be a 1. And just based on observations and, you know, reading, listening to Holistic Management 3rd Edition audiobook about 7 times, I feel that, and discussions with my dad, I feel that we're somewhere around 7 or 7.5 on the brittleness scale.
Gotcha.
That's just an observation, you know. Observation, personal feeling, and I have a lot of those. I can't necessarily back up with any hard scientific data, but it works for me.
Sounds good. Brian, thanks for your time today.
Anytime, Clay. Pleasure to visit with you. I'm looking forward to being on the podcast. Thank you very much.
I haven't got next week's episode nailed down yet. I thought I was ahead of myself last week on the episode announcement, so I'm not going to do that again this week, but I do really look forward to kind of the outline I've got sketched of these episodes coming up, and really hope that you are enjoying them. If you are, I wouldn't mind if you would head on over to workingcows.net/subscribe, and if you would also just share it with somebody via social media, text message, whatever it is. Just let somebody know that you are listening to these episodes and that they're making a difference in your ranch business. And appreciate you guys and really look forward to next week on the Working Cows Podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.